Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 185, featuring Bill Spradlin from Zoic Studio. Before I get into Bill and the amazing podcast we recorded together, I want to apologize for not having put out a podcast last week. Unfortunately, I was on vacation and I was in a remote area of Montana, which had very, very poor internet access, which was great for vacation because it allowed me to hang out with my family and celebrate my dad's 80th birthday. Big extended family was there. And to do some amazing fly fishing while I was there. But unfortunately, it meant that because of the poor internet connection, no podcast was able to be put out. So it's a week late, but hopefully you guys will be okay with it. And if you are a loyal podcast listener, you probably are going to listen to this right away. Hopefully you are. And if you are, you're probably listening to this while you're at SIGGRAPH, because this is coming out right as SIGGRAPH starts. And there's going to be a lot of cool stuff going on there. So if you are listening to this right now, let us know. And you should come by and say hi. And there's going to be a lot of interesting things going on. If you want to check out all the amazing things that Chaos Group is doing at SIGGRAPH, go to chaosgroup.com/SIGGRAPH2018 and check out all the talks we're doing. We're doing amazing V-Ray Days, as well as several other talks that are not part of V-Ray Days that we're participating in. So there's going to be a lot of interesting things going on. Love to see you there. And if you have any ideas of podcasts that you guys want to hear that want me to record while I'm there, because of course I will always be recording podcasts when I go to events, let me know and say, hey, you should do a podcast with this person while you're here. And just email us labs@chaosgroup.com and we'll figure that out if we can make that happen. Okay, on to Bill. Bill, I've known Bill for a while. I've worked on several projects with him. He's an extremely talented artist, and he is a VFX supervisor at Zoic now. I've worked with him as an artist over at Digital Domain on projects like Oblivion. I think that was the first project I worked with him on. One of the things I've admired the most about Bill is that he, not just as an artist, but as a person, he is extremely calm. And he tends to take everything in stride really, really well, which means, as you know, I was his lighting supervisor at DD, I was able to give him the most challenging shots because most other people would be in a table flipping situation because things were not working. And he just managed to methodically go through it and do everything in stride and make them look really good without necessarily letting the best of, you know, the technical challenges get the best of him. So I've always admired him that way. And he's a really great guy. He's, you know, this conversation we have with Bill sort of, you know, dovetails into some of the things we've done together in the past, but also, you know, the challenges of working in episodic and why he sometimes likes it much more than working in feature films, as well as several other things. So he's a really, really cool guy. I really like working with Bill in the past, and I think he's a really talented person. And, you know, it's cool because Zoic is just a half a block away from our office in LA, so I'll think I'm going to go hang out with him more often because he's just a really interesting person. Anyway, hopefully you guys will enjoy this great podcast with Bill Spradlin from Zoic Studio. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
The first thing we were talking about was...
How we met. Right.
Which was at Digital Domain.
Mm-hmm.
On Oblivion, right?
That's right.
And I guess that was... I was telling you how I had never worked with you before, even though you had worked there, you said, since Flags of Our Fathers.
Well, I came in at the end of Flags. I wasn't on Flags. I came in for Meet the Robinsons. The stereo conversion project that they did.
That's right.
Disney.
So Meet the Robinsons was right. A Disney show.
It was, yeah.
And then I guess DD helped with the conversion, right?
Yeah, they brought that in. I guess Jeff Baksinski was involved in that. And that's how I came to DD. He and I worked at Warner Brothers Visual Effects.
Oh, okay. Jeff and you.
Yeah, Jeff and I.
And he's at Zoic now, right?
He's at Zoic now, yeah.
Okay, okay. But we'll get back to that.
I know. Yeah. And so I came there for Meet the Robinsons. I was one of the leads on that show, doing the stereo conversion for Disney, which was an interesting project in and of itself.
Yeah.
Were you aware like of that?
I was aware. I think that was happening right as I was leaving, maybe.
Okay.
Because I left after Stealth. So it was right after Stealth or maybe during Stealth.
It was like Super Ex-Girlfriend Zoom around that
time.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Charles was on that and Paul and those guys. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So I was right after I left on Stealth. So that's when you guys started. And so that's when we didn't cross paths. And then you were working on a bunch of different shows that I wasn't working on.
Yep.
And you said you started doing some stuff on Maleficent, right?
Yeah. Well, I came back when we met. I came back. I'd left DD after 2012 and kind of traveled around a bit. I went to Weta, Animalogic.
Nice.
Dr. D.
Other side of the time zone.
Yeah.
Or the dateline.
Right. Which was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then I came back to DD for Iron Man 3.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the bankruptcy happened. And and then that's when we met. They moved me over off Iron Man 3 to Oblivion.
To Oblivion, yeah. Right. So it was interesting because when I started on the show and they sang, it's like, oh yeah, here's your crew, because I was the lighting soup on it. And I said, you got this guy and you got Bill Spradlin too. And I said, who's that? And I was like, you don't know Bill? And I was like, I guess I've never worked with Bill. And I was always sort of admired when we started with you. What I thing I noticed was what a calm demeanor you had, and that was really kind of cool to feel that because we had some very very challenging shots.
Yeah,
and I knew it was going to be very frustrating to figure out, because of the enormous amount of rendering time it was going to take to fix it.
Right.
And it was for Oblivion on the drones. Were they called drones? What were they called?
They were drones, yeah. They had like different numbers on
Right, them, like, 183 was the big one, I think, that we were working on.
Right.
He was like the quirky one.
Yeah.
Right? But there was these close-up shots of the red eye and the lensing moving in and out as it was zooming and focusing.
Yep.
And it was hard to render that and make it look good, right?
It was, yeah. That was probably one of the biggest challenges I'd come up against lighting-wise up to that point.
Really?
You know, super reflective, highly refractive, you know, metallic with a light source right in the middle of it.
Well, it's like the ultimate ray tracing thing, right?
Yeah.
You had to go through all these lenses and it had to... the light had to come through, bounce and bounce and bounce and bounce and bounce.
Yep.
It's, but you had mentioned that this was not dissimilar from another problem you had on Speed Racer, right?
Yeah, because we had the spinning cars with the headlights. Mm-hmm. That was a different renderer, Mental Ray. Mm-hmm. But those render times were also super, super challenging. I think I remember I had one. I had a shot. It was kind of a medium close-up of the car spinning and the headlight flying by camera, rotating by camera, and that the render times were up in the 40 plus hour per frame.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. But we were challenged by that. And by the end, we just basically said, well, we're just going to put it on the farm and it's going to be a slow burn, right? We had a few of those that happened.
Right.
But with people like Eric Barba and Joe Kaczynski, they weren't going to tolerate anything but something looking perfectly right.
Yeah, there's no compromise there.
No,
so you've got to do it the right way.
Right. So we did it the right way. It just involved like a 20-hour frame render, which was crazy. Interestingly, when I started at Chaos Group, one of the new features in V-Ray was specifically something that would fight that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to take those... frames now and render them, they probably render in 20 minutes or less.
Yeah, yeah, easily.
Yeah. So we've solved some of those issues. And just to note for the render geeks out there, it's because we're a biased renderer. And so we know when what's important and what's not important. Anyway, that was fun. But the other thing that I thought was interesting to me, or was a challenge to me, was that you were a very senior, very accomplished artist, and an older guy. And I don't know, probably you're probably still younger than me, but I felt like you're like coming into someone. I was used to bringing in new lighters mm-hmm. that were much younger, so I could sort of mentor them, et cetera. Right. But you were not that person. You were a person that like very well accomplished, done a lot of stuff. And I always felt a little bit humbled by you, honestly speaking. I really was. And I think that's also a challenge because some people feel like they have to assert themselves in certain ways.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's fair.
No, and like I never felt like you did that with me. I always felt really comfortable working with you.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate it.
I think that's, you know, that's a mistake people often make is trying to assert themselves over people when it's, you know, like my point of view is that I want to bring in people who are better than me, who are, you know, excel in areas that I'm weak in.
Right.
Because that's, you know, that's ultimately what you want. Because mm-hmm. I want people who are, you know, they're way better at what they do than I am.
Yeah, because that's going to make you better.
Exactly. Right? That's going to bring my game up.
Yeah. I can definitely tell you, for example, when I work with Daniel Buck.
Yeah.
And you know Daniel because was on Oblivion as well.
For sure.
And he was way younger than me, but I already knew that he knew way more about car rendering at the time than I ever did. So I learned from Daniel, you know, when he was only 22 years old,
right,
about how to do certain kinds of rendering.
Yeah.
That's great, you know, and it's good for me because it makes me look good too.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's really just, you know, setting aside the ego and learning from each other mm-hmm. and, you know, recognizing where people excel and nurturing that.
Right.
And learning from them as well.
And now, I mean, you'd been a lead, you know, here and there up to that point, but now mm-hmm. you're you know, a supervisor of at Zoic, right? And you've been there how long now?
It's been it'll be 4 years this year.
4 years. Okay. Right. So which is great. And we're talking about the irony that you've been half a block from me for that long, and this is the first time we've had lunch, which is kind of sad.
It is.
But what is that like? What is it like to be a supervisor, and what's that change been like to you?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big challenge for me, just on a personal level. Going to Zoic was that, you know, primarily before that, my career has been all film mm-hmm. with some commercial work here and there. And so there's two things that I had to adapt to, and that was, you know, the speed at which Episodics operates at.
Significantly faster.
Oh, yeah, significant. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, you know, hours. In hours to days instead of, you know, weeks to months,
right,
to get something done. And then being a CG supervisor, which is in and of itself, you know, was a step up for me. You know, I'd been a lighter and look dev guy mm-hmm. primarily before that, so I didn't have like the animation chops or the effects like Houdini knowledge and mm-hmm. stuff like that, which I had to learn kind of on the fly.
Yeah, you suddenly had to have an opinion about something that you're not an expert in, right?
Exactly. And then in those instances, I really relied upon the artist's knowledge. I try to lean on the people that knew what they were doing. Like, so if there was an animation note, or if I wasn't, you know, if I was trying to get a performance out of an animator I wasn't quite getting, I would talk to another animator, like a senior animator there, and get their opinion and bring them into the conversation and say, hey, this is what we're trying to do. You know,
how do we solve
this? Yeah, how do we solve
this? I mean, that goes back to what you were just saying about like relying on people that know more than you do, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, you got to have trust in people, right, especially when you're a supervisor or a lead. You know, it's not all about doing everything yourself.
Right.
It's all about being the person that does everything. It's really, for me, I come at it from we're all a team, we're working together. Mm-hmm. So let's solve this together.
So one of the other things is, in terms of episodic now, episodic is a big deal.
Yep.
In some cases, I think it's actually challenging film in terms of watchability, right? A lot of people are watching. I mean, the thing that keeps coming up is like Game of Thrones, right?
Yep.
Game of Thrones has raised a bar as to what episodic work needs to be,
right,
or where it can be. And that in itself is challenging a lot of films, right? You can see a lot of films where Game of Thrones looks better than some films, right?
Sure.
There's two kinds of films that you're talking about. You're talking about in the episodic world, you've got the broadcast films that are come out one episode a week.
Yep.
And they offer their own visual effects challenges. And then you have the streaming ones. So tell me a little bit about the differences between those.
Right. So you've got the kind of weekly release schedule of broadcast. So you have a show like, I'll use Arrow as an example because I supervise that.
Mm-hmm.
There's 22 episodes in a season.
Yeah, of Arrow.
And right. And so you've got a production schedule that in the beginning of the season, you've got about a month lead time from plate turnover to delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And then that compresses the closer you get to Christmas due to, just the production schedule and air dates. So towards the end of the season, you're overlapping actually where you're working on two episodes at the same time. So you're delivering like every week.
You've got constantly.
Right. You got weekly deliveries for like on a Friday for an episode that airs the following Tuesday.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's short.
Super short.
Super short.
Right.
So you don't have much choices there. You have to like, good, let's move on.
Yeah. And that's, that's in and of itself has been why I've enjoyed working in episodics a lot, because I'd worked in film, for a long time. And the one thing that I didn't like about film was just the length of time that you had to work on stuff. Sometimes you could be working on the same thing for
months.
Yeah, months, 3, 4, 5
one
months.
One shot.
Yeah, one shot for like 3 months.
Yeah.
And so it got a little stagnant. Like you kind of want to, I always wanted more of a challenge, I guess.
Right.
And
or change of pace.
Change of pace, yeah. Right. It's a good word. Good way to put it. With episodics, you've got, a week, 2 weeks.
And sometimes a few hours, right?
Yeah, something could come in at the last minute and you've got, the client says, hey, can you guys fix this or do that? And you've got to turn around in, 6 hours.
So the other thing that is interesting is that the pipeline is very different, right?
It is, yeah.
Because your artists have to be way more generalist than in the traditional film pipeline.
Yeah, there's not a lot of specialists, I guess you could say. Everybody's kind of a generalist because you have to be able to tackle problems from any area really that come up. There are people that kind of lean more in the texture, lighting, look dev, or like animation rigging.
Okay.
Or things like that.
Yeah, I can see that. Like I can see someone that's like, I can build all the models and make the whole set and render it and composite it. That can be one person.
Right.
But having a character animator do the same thing is like, it's a kind of a different brain, right? A little bit.
Yeah, it is. And that's where you do need to have people who are specialized in things.
Right.
Like if you do need a character animator or somebody who is really good at animating like cars or vehicles or helicopters.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah.
Those are all very different things. And
very different motion, right?
Yeah. And so sometimes you need that specialist in that instance.
Yeah.
In the more like kind of creative realms of that, the aspects of what we do, animation, I think, falls into that where you do find more specialists in that regard. But generally speaking, usually we've got people that can do modeling, texturing, lighting and rendering. They're doing the
they're doing all of it.
Yeah,
yeah, because they was like, I need a building here, and I need it in 6 hours. You're not going to go through a process of a pipeline with seven different people to do that,
right?
Yeah, that doesn't sound efficient.
No,
but the quality of generalists now actually I think has increased quite a bit. So they can actually pull that off, and it looks really, really good. Where you can, you don't necessarily need the huge pipeline to do things,
right?
But some of the streaming stuff, as we you know, those things are actually they come out in a big batch, right?
Yep.
So as it comes out as a big batch, you don't have to worry about every week delivering something.
Exactly.
So you can treat it like a 6 or 10 hour movie of some kind, right?
Yeah, it's more like a smaller film kind of production pipeline.
Okay.
For those type of things where you've got, you know, maybe 300 or 400 shots.
Right.
Throughout the series.
That's kind of cool though.
And then, you know, you've got 10 months to work on it.
Right.
Right.
Yes. That's actually kind of cool to think about, like, yeah, okay, so. Well, that, I guess that's how Game of Thrones is, right?
Yeah.
Because they're like 6 episodes per season now, which is so small.
Right. Yeah. But I mean,
that's huge.
Yeah. They're like hour and a half. The ones that are going to be coming out in the next season, they're like hour and a half, 2 hour episodes. So those are films.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. And these sequences, like the Lutrine sequence, is ridiculous. And the Battle of the Bastards is ridiculous. Yeah.
That was insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have yet to see some stuff as good as that in certain films, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really, really impressive. So I think the other thing that's interesting also is that on some of those streaming services, people who go out there and buy their 4K HDR TVs, the best way to see that content is to actually see it on a 4K HD TV is through streaming services, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is the widest available platform, I think, for 4K HDR content right now.
So that means you have to deliver stuff for that content that's possibly superior, or many times superior than film quality, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that in and of itself brings its own challenges,
right?
You know? The streaming stuff, you've got a little bit longer timeline, like I said, so it's, you kind of factor all that stuff in when you're dealing with it. But not so much, you know, with the broadcast, you're not dealing with that sort of thing.
Right.
So we're still doing stuff at 2K and whatnot, so.
And when we were out to lunch, you mentioned, speaking of TV, you mentioned that Star Trek was something that sort of blew your mind as a kid and may have possibly brought you into this industry. So to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I remember, like I was telling you at lunch, I remember sitting in the living room, my grandma's house, watching Star Trek, the TV show.
Right, with William Shatner, the first one.
The Shatner one, yeah. Right. It was reruns of that.
Sure.
And, you know, I saw this shot of his, you know, your standard Enterprise Establisher just kind of in space.
Right. Kind of zooming by screen or something.
Yeah. And I was like, wow. I was like, I turned to my uncle and I said, are they up there, right? Are they in space right now? And he was like, no, it's, you know, they it's not real. And just not understanding, like, it not being real and how that happened, how that process takes place,
right,
kind of sparked my imagination as like, wow, this is something that may, you know, that I want to do. I want to be involved in something like that.
Interesting.
Then I think Empire Strikes Back, which I think was a big inspiration for a lot of people.
It was. You know? What was it about it for you?
I think it was because it was probably around that age of when I was really, I think I saw it when I was about 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always been kind of drawn towards like science fiction, fantasy type stuff, storylines. And so there was something about it. I haven't put a lot of thought into like what exactly it was that drew me into it. But I think it was just that very kind of traditional story of of good versus evil, and then you've got, you know, all of the effects that go along with it. Like, I was just blown away by all of the miniature work and everything that mm-hmm. they had done, and like, I had started drawing like Star Wars stuff after that. Just,
but it was also like nonstop. the anti Flash Gordon, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And also, you know, a lot of people love Clash of the Titans, but it's like, you know, after a while, Harryhausen is an amazing stop motion artist, but right. Tippett was a different league in some cases. You know, he'd taken to a new level,
right?
And I think, I don't know, I still watch it. You know, I have it at home. I watch it constantly. It's one of my favorites. I think it's a story, and we talked about it with Thrawn ad nauseam. Mm-hmm. But it's a story. It's an incredible thing. But I love the environments as well. Like, right. you're on the ice planet. You start off, it's cold, and then you go to the jungle, and then you go to space, and then you go to the clouds. Like, that's a journey of it's a beautiful matte paintings left and right.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
And I think that's really cool. So how you were six, mm-hmm. and if that little bug was in your head when you were six, how did you move your career in that direction from there?
Yeah, it was a kind of a long, winding, roundabout way to get where I am now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of stuck with me for a long time. And I started just drawing and doing that kind of stuff mm-hmm. on my own. And it was the 80s, so I got into computers
right
pretty heavily. My dad worked at
the Atari and a Commodore and all that stuff.
Yeah. I had a Commodore 64. And then, like, my first PC was an 8086.
Okay. Do you remember which brand it was? Was it like a Gateway or something?
It was like a HP or something like that, maybe. Uh-huh. I had a 20 megabyte hard drive, I think, that weighed probably more than I did.
That's pretty big.
It was huge.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't move the computer by myself.
Wow.
You know, I was like 8 or 9 years old, mm-hmm. whatever. And my dad, he was a computer salesman.
Really?
Yeah. And so we always had computers. Like, I had an Apple II SE, like, in the house. Like, you would just bring stuff home and we'd play around with it.
Wow.
So I got really into computers. And as I got older, I began, like, taking them apart and, like, building my own stuff with them. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up, like, being the kid in the neighborhood who fixed everybody else's parents' computer.
Yep.
When it broke.
Yep.
So...
call Bill. Billy's going to come here. He's going to fix our computer.
Yeah, exactly. That's what happened. So I ended up going into the IT industry.
Right. So you were tech support for the neighborhood, and then you became official tech support.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I got my first computer job when I was, I think, 19. I was going into this computer store like every week to buy parts because I was fixing like my friend's parents' computers.
Yeah.
And the guy, the owner there was like, hey, you know, you're in here a lot. And I, you know, we've talked a bit and you seem to know what you're talking about. Do you want a job? And I was like, sure, why not?
Right.
And so I just started building computers for him mm-hmm. in his little computer store. I did that for maybe like a year or so. And then I got a job working for a company that managed funeral homes.
Where was this?
This is in Florida.
Okay.
And their headquarters was in New Orleans, but they're a pretty big company.
Okay.
They had funeral homes like all over South America and Europe and America. Oh,
yeah. Okay. Global.
Yeah. International company. And so, I worked like in their Southeast division, which was New Orleans, Florida, and Puerto Rico. And okay. so I'd have to go to Puerto Rico to go to do support, set up networks and stuff like that. And I did that for, it was about 7 years. And because I just kind of fell into that career, mm-hmm. like I was never really happy. Like I did it because I was good at it.
Right.
And it was just kind of like, oh, this is kind of what I'm doing. And after a while, you know, I just I took time to really evaluate like what I really wanted to do. And
right.
I kind of went back to my childhood and like, you know, I always wanted to do this.
Oh, you went back to Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah. I always wanted to go.
Yeah.
I wanted to work on movies, work in film, do something like that.
Right.
And so, there was a school, Full Sail, in Orlando that was close to where I lived. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you know, let me just check this place out. Let me see what it's about, see what they can do. Mm-hmm. Went there, checked it out. They have an amazing campus. It's mm-hmm. pretty insane. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's crazy. They were primarily, they did a lot of like audio and like stuff like that. But they had a computer animation program that I went through mm-hmm. and did that. And then I spent about a year and a half, got my degree. And then through one of the guys that I was in school with, he got contacted by a company out in San Diego for a job. And he brought me into that working on, we were doing, it's like cutscene cinematics for a video game.
Okay. Which company was it?
It was Pendulum Studios.
Okay.
Down in San Diego. I'm not sure if they're still around. I haven't kept in touch with them. But.
All right.
So that was like my first gig in the industry.
So you moved from Florida to San Diego.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, that must have been a big move.
It was huge. I was leaving my family, friends.
Right.
Girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
Behind. It's all. But that's, I felt enough conviction that this was the right thing for me.
Yep. So you just hopped on the 10 and went to the end.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's interesting because I started off at age of six. Mm-hmm. I said I was going to be an architect, and I went all the way and became an architect. I got master's in architecture, everything. And then I remember at some point I just don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going into visual effects. It was an easy transition for me because I already knew all the right tools. It's almost like I had this backup plan in the back of my head subconsciously the whole time. It's like, bloop, just move right over.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that put it in the back of my head was because I was an architect, I worked for a contractor and I was framing houses and stuff because I wanted to learn about, you know, how to build a house because an architect's a good skill to learn especially when you're, not 19, 20 years old or whatever. And so I'm framing houses and this contractor's like, why the hell do you want to be an architect? It's like, man, you're such a, wizard with computers and stuff. It's like, you should do like video games or, movies or whatever. And I was like, really? I just never thought of it,
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I think that stayed in my back of my head. And I think that's what put it. But you had this sort of reverse thing. It's like you saw this thing of the movies and then suddenly like, oh, I remember that movie thing.
Right. Yeah. And the technical aspects of being in systems and network admin stuff, I think helped me in this position do all the problem solving and things like that. You had to.
Well, we have a lot of that, right? Right.
Problem solving and like being patient. The people we talked about that earlier, which I think is super important.
Right, that's why I gave you those really hard shots. Even though I barely knew you, I already sensed like this guy is going to be fine.
You're right. We'll get through it.
We'll get through it.
Yeah,
don't worry. I put it on a farm, Chris. He'll be done sometime next week. but and that I think that's right. I mean, the having gone through that process of problem solving, so those years weren't wasted.
No, definitely not. I mean, I learned a lot, and it wasn't, even though the skill set wasn't directly transferable. The things that I learned, how to think logically, how to problem solve, how to deal with people.
Sure.
I think were key and instrumental in who I am today. And definitely as a supervisor, I think that's helped.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost, you just mentioned it earlier when you were, Zoic is like, there's a problem. I can't exactly identify what it is. So I know how to get to the right person to get this problem solved. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, there may be a network token problem on an IT side, and it's like, I'm not sure about that, but I know a guy who knows about it, so we can get him to solve this problem for her to solve this problem. So that's an important part of that process. Well, that's great. That's great. So you're in San Diego. So where did that lead you?
Yeah, so I was in San Diego there for, it was about 6 months. And
not that long. So,
yeah, because it was about 18 minutes of cutscene cinematics, and
okay,
we were all the guys on the team were pretty much straight out of school, and we just,
oh right, so young, yeah,
yeah, and so we just cranked through that as fast as possible, and I'd wanted to move to LA, and there was an opportunity at Pacific Title through another friend that I had went to mm-hmm. school with. And so I went there for a bit. And then my roommate at the time, it was Dan Neufeld, who I had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
He was working on the, for this little previous company, working out the virtual directing stuff for Cameron for Avatar.
Right.
And so
they've worked on that for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I think they've been working on Avatar 2, 3, and 4 since Avatar 1 came out, and that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's been forever.
Mm-hmm.
But he was my roommate, and he was working there. And one of the guys that was working there with him was Jeff Beksinski.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so Jeff had gotten a call from Warner Brothers. They were trying to start up their like visual effects department, or again, I guess they'd gone through several iterations of trying to have a visual effects division
mm-hmm.
at Warner. And yeah. So they brought him in.
They were trying to do their own internal visual effects.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I guess they had finished up Curious George, I think is what it was internally. And they had,
interesting.
And they did that and then laid off a bunch of people. And then brought Jeff in, and Jeff had asked my roommate, he's like, hey, do you know anybody that's, you know, looking for a job or something? And I was at Pac Title. It was really slow.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of in the summer. We weren't really doing anything. And he called me up, and he always laughs about this because he asked me, he was like, so, you know, he told me what was going on. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that sounds cool. And he was like, okay, well, when can you start? And I was like, well, you know, I need to give these guys notice and maybe in a couple of weeks. And he was like, okay, sounds good. And I was like, well, do you want to see my resume or my demo reel?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, nope. I should have known right then and there.
Yeah.
When somebody doesn't want to see your demo reel.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It means you're about to get into... to a can of worms or something.
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
No. But
you were a warm body.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it was. But I love Jeff. I worked with him at Warner.
And at DD and at Zoic.
And at DD, yeah. All three places.
So obviously he's had an influence on your life. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's been great. He was head of studio at DD for a while, and then he left.
Mm-hmm.
And then... he had brought me over after Warner Brothers. I went to Hydraulics to work on. I worked on a Tool music video over there.
Okay.
And which was fun. It was different. And
yeah, it's too bad they closed. They were a cool studio.
Were they?
Do it? I don't know. Oh no.
Hydraulics.
I was thinking about Asylum.
Oh yeah, Asylum.
Hydraulics is a little bit tough. I've heard some difficult things of them.
Yeah, I mean it's. I personally. Didn't have a hard time there.
Okay.
But there were a lot of people that I've heard, you know, had difficult times.
The brothers, right? It's two brothers.
Colin and Greg.
Colin and Greg. Right. Yeah. They were, I don't know. Are they still around?
I'm not sure. I know they moved somewhere. There was that incident with one of their producers a couple of years ago who disappeared.
Right. He's remember? The guy. It was all over the news.
Yeah. Right,
he disappeared and like they found him in Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. He showed up in somebody's Facebook feed.
Right.
In a random picture in Mexico. I have no idea what happened.
He just walked off the set or something. Right. And then it was like, it made the news about, you know, the stress of the visual effects industry or whatever it was.
That was right around the time when things were, I guess the protests and whatnot after Life of Pi.
Yes, it was right after Life of Pi.
So there was a lot of media attention happening
mm-hmm.
for us. Which has all kind of died down.
Yeah, unfortunately. I kind of knew it would. I just hoped that it would have, something would be solved.
Something significant would have come from it.
Yeah, it didn't. Yeah, it didn't. I think what happened, honestly speaking, from those days where everything, like, you know, the life of Pi days, let's just put it that way. I think everyone just made a choice.
Right.
Like, I'm going to, here's how I'm going to solve my personal problem. I'm not going to, since there was no union, right? You know, like, I solved the problem by saying, I'm going to get out of visual effect and production work. I'm not actually got out of visual effects. I'm actually helping visual effects a lot through my new job, but I was just going to get out of production work because it was just not going to work for me anymore. But, you know, TV is a little bit different. Obviously, still a lot of TV gets done in tax-subsidized areas. A lot of stuff done in Vancouver over there for Zoic. But you guys still have a standing here. You still have a job at Zoic, right?
Yeah.
So that's you know, you're not forced to move, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, and it's been interesting the last, I guess, 4 or 5 years. I've seen kind of – there's been kind of waves of increased work that's come back to LA.
Different work, right?
Yeah, different work. There's been, you know, there's the new tax incentives that were passed, I guess, last year or the year before.
I mean, it's not huge.
It's not huge, but it makes, there's a little bit of a bump there.
What I found also was interesting, and it seems to be especially on the compositing side of things, very senior compositors are got a lot of work. Because they're going in like the cleaner, right?
Right.
Fixing stuff. Like, I'll fix your stuff now. It's like, you're in trouble. You're not going to be able to deliver a show, but I'm going to hire like some guy who's going to cost a fortune, but it's going to be done.
Right.
And so those guys are making bank in LA because they're getting stuff done, right?
Yeah. It's been like staffing is, it's always been a challenge because there was that initial wave of people that when, work started going to Vancouver, a lot of people either left, went to Vancouver.
Or left the industry.
Left the industry. There was a huge brain drain, I guess you could say, of talent that just went off and said, okay, I've had enough. Let's do something else.
So I just to make that point a little clearer, the VR, you know, boom that happened.
Right.
I think 7 out of 10 of the VR companies are in Southern California.
Right.
And I don't think that's an accident.
No.
I think those are all visual effects people who left and decided to get into VR.
Well, how many ex-VFX people do you know that went into VR? I know tons.
A lot.
Dozens.
And especially very senior ones.
Yeah. A lot of the senior people.
And the technical people.
Right.
They all went into VR.
Yep.
And so that the VR revolution was like, here's my way out of visual effects.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting. What do you think about VR?
I don't think it's got the legs that AR has. I think AR,
practically speaking,
it has probably got more practical applications than VR does. Like, you know, back in the 90s, I'm sure you remember, like, VR was this huge thing. And, you know, back in like 91, 92, when you got,
yeah, it was too heavy.
Right. Yeah. Like, there wasn't enough, you know, technology behind it at that point. I was just thinking about that and like, do you remember Lawnmower Man?
Yes, of course I do.
Have you tried to watch that recently?
No.
You should.
I probably should.
It's but a,
I
don't want
to. It's an, not that, yeah.
Besides all the technical things of it, there's some interesting social things going on there.
There's weird sexual things in there too. That is just bizarre. Yeah. But I mean, it's VR, whatever.
Sure. Right.
But there are, okay. So what's interesting to me, and I've been doing a lot of VR stuff, right? VR is actually very practical for certain things. So for architecture, it's like extraordinarily practical. The whole point of VR is to take you to a place that doesn't exist, and that's what architects do every day, right? VR makes perfect sense in that world. So on the, let's call it enterprise level, where we're trying to actually do something, VR makes sense. The thing that disappoints me about VR is where they keep shoving it into the entertainment field and games, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And games and movies, right?
And that's really the only exposure to it that I've had. So that's,
I know,
that's what's limiting my opinion of it.
Exactly. But the problem I have is that they keep just we'll just take this game and put it in VR.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't work. Even something that's a first-person experience in the game doesn't always work in I mean, I saw someone try to play Skyrim in VR, and they were just smacking furniture left and right,
right,
because that's what you do, right?
Yeah.
Just not a good idea. And then the same thing with films. They're like, they see it as an extension of stereo, and it's like, that's not what it's about.
No, definitely not.
And I have seen examples of both of those things, games and narrative, let's just call it narrative, which were actually really well executed. They're extraordinarily rare. Everyone just goes, you know, here's what frustrates me a little bit. And I know I actually got some good friends of mine that make this content, so I'm not blaming them on it.
Sure.
But they'll go in there and they'll be like, okay, here's this movie. I don't know. Let's just call Get Out, right? Let's just they make a VR experience of Get Out. Literally, that's what they try to do.
Right.
It's like, why? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
And what is that going to serve? That's not going to convince someone to buy a VR headset.
Right.
And they think that they're going to buy a VR headset in the same way that they buy a PS4.
Yeah.
And that's not what it's for. It's something different. And I think that that's the problem. Now, it's not going to be this massive thing that people are going to adopt everywhere.
Right.
It's going to be for very specific examples, for experiences, or for practical tools that you're going to need VR. But I think you're right about AR. AR is going to be big.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it's also users being apprehensive to putting something on their head and using it for extensive period of times? I think we saw that with 3D TVs and people having to put glasses on, like there was resistance to that.
Yeah. Even 3D TV can make you sick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a problem with VR as well, just from if I'm in there for more than 5 or 6 minutes, I start getting dizzy and my head hurts.
Depends on the VR experience. And I have to tell you, there are...
I'm sure there's some that are way better than others.
So have you played... There's a VR game, and it's like one of the only games I see like, yeah, it makes sense in VR.
Mm.
It's called Beat Saber. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
It's basically like Guitar Hero with lightsabers and cubes. And you're basically holding the two handles, and you're supposed to the beat, slice these cubes.
Oh, okay.
But it gives you full 6 degrees of freedom. So there's no lag either, and it's like it totally makes sense. Now, you do still have that issue of like your eyes have a different focus when you're in VR. You've got VR hair. Your hair gets all smashed up.
Yep.
You've got problems with glasses.
Yeah.
You accidentally smack the furniture or your friend next to you. There's a lot of problems, and I just don't see. Yeah. And I've seen some of the, when I'm going to like some VFX conference or something like FMX, there's always going to be one nerdy guy on an airplane that's putting on a VR headset to watch a movie.
Right.
And he's like, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
but I don't know. I think it's interesting. Do you think that's going to affect your world? Like cinematic or episodic world? Or I don't think it's going to be in that world for a long time, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some things where, I don't remember the exact TV show. I think it was one of the NCIS or one of those police shows where you could follow the experience after the episode. So you
can, VR?
Right. You can log on to this VR site, and then they had like a crime scene VR experience that you could walk through and try to find clues and stuff like that.
Right.
So I've seen attempts at it. I don't know how successful it's been.
I've heard, and I may be completely wrong, and I want people to correct me if they hear this, but I've heard that, for example, some of the mobile games that follow along the story of an episodic. So I think there's like a Walking Dead mobile game.
Yeah, right.
Right? I don't watch Walking Dead, unfortunately.
I think so. Right.
And the game, you follow along and you play, and it's sort of related towards whatever the episode. So every week it changes a little bit to do the new thing or updates itself based on the new thing. I heard they make so like orders of magnitudes more money on the game.
Really?
Than they do just, you know, selling the episode.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. Like really a lot of money. Mobile games is.
That's huge.
It's insane. Yeah. The micropayments is insane.
Yeah. The microtransactions and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. I've noticed that in a lot of games. Like,
you still play games?
I do from time to time. Like, funny story. So when I was younger, I first got into games, obviously, when I was a kid.
Yeah, you had all those computers. 64.
Yeah. Right. So that kind of turned me onto the scene. And then as I got older, I think when I was about 19 or 20, I think Ultima Online came out.
Oh, right. My God.
The grandfather
of online games.
MMORPGs. Uh-huh. And I, immediately that was like, holy shit, this is.
Yeah.
This is amazing. Like I had never seen anything like that. I've got some really good stories from that game.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was,
and I'm sure you were playing very, very late hours into the night.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're 19, 20 years old. What else are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
My friend ran, he had a web hosting company out of his house. So he had 5T1s in his house.
Was it a BBS of some kind or?
No.
Oh, no, web hosting.
Yeah, websites.
Okay.
He was running, he had full NT, Windows NT servers running out of his house. Wow. And so he had 5T1s, which was at the time.
It's amazing.
Crazy. Right. I mean, nobody had that kind of, at home I had.
It's 5 megabits of data.
Yeah, I had a 28.8
right.
modem
right.
at my house, which, you know, was great. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So we would all play. There's like four or five of us. We'd sit there on his network and play Ultima Online together. We had our own little guild, ran around, and we all started off trying to be noble and good. And then, you know.
You turned evil?
I turned evil, yeah. Turned to the dark side.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah, it does. It's so easy. It's so tempting.
Well, I kept
especially if you get bored.
Well, I kept getting killed by these guys, and I was like, man, what are they doing, you know, that I'm not doing? And so one day after they killed me, I just started talking to them and they're super cool. They're like really cool guys.
Right.
They're like, yeah, we're just, they're kind of role playing the bad guys. And I was like, oh, that's kind of fun. Like it's interesting. And so there's like this whole Ultima Online had real role playing people, like people that really
they would embrace the role.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was like Dungeons and Dragons, right?
Yeah. So you had people that were super into, you know, like, oh, I'm a bard, and they would just run around with a flute and play songs. Yep. That's all they would do. And then like, you would like give them tips for gold or whatever, and that was their thing. people had got married in the game, like real life.
Oh, right.
Marriages.
They met each other.
Yeah, they had like a, they'd have like a wedding ceremony and stuff and big group of people.
Yeah. And this is pre-Warcraft, right?
Yeah. Yeah. This was the first one. It was Ultima Online. And then, I guess the next big one was EverQuest.
Yeah.
The first EverQuest, that came out. I was in a big guild on there and, I bought a Rolex watch because of that game.
Wait, what?
So, the guild that I was in, they did a lot of raiding, like in this area was where, you know, you had to have 40 people to go in and kill dragons and stuff. And so there was not very many people on the server that had like these items that you can get in that area. And by virtue of being in the guild, I, you know, had all these really rare items and my account was, I had a lot of high level characters. So at that time, you could just go on eBay and say, I want to sell this item in this game. That was before they blocked all of the virtual item selling.
Oh, eBay allowed you to sell virtual items.
Yeah. Back in the day.
Right.
It did. And so I would go on there, like when I quit playing the game, I was like, well, my friend, he was 16. He sold his account and bought a car, like his first car. His parents didn't buy him a car. He bought like a $5,000.
So someone paid $5,000 for his character.
Yeah. His character, all of his items, and he bought himself his first car. Wow. So I was like, well, I'm going to do that. And so that's what I did. And I made about $4,000 and I bought a Rolex watch with it.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It's a funny story. I mean, I have a lot of really good stories from gaming, but
Parker and I were playing Guild Wars 2.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
For a while.
I couldn't get into that because you couldn't jump.
Yeah. It was hard. I know what you mean. It's
a weird thing to get hung up on.
Yeah. No, I actually had a problem just controlling my character through the jumping puzzles. Because there's a lot of jumping puzzles where you have to
maybe it was Guild Wars 1 where you couldn't jump.
Well, there was puzzles. You had to jump to through a thing to get to a thing and then you would solve it. And I was just terrible at it. I could slash and burn, but I couldn't jump very well. just stupid. But yeah, Parker ended up finding some miners. And what I mean by miners, not small people, but people who are mining the game.
Right.
In China.
Like gold farmers?
Gold farmers. Yeah. And he would buy, because you could buy gold from the game, quote unquote, officially.
Mm-hmm.
But he found it where you could buy it for one-fifth of the price of the official gold.
And you could resell it in the game?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So you could buy it for cheaper. And
yeah.
Right.
And he would do that, but he also just had a way more gold than most people should have.
Yeah.
And he was just let's go into battle. It's like, if you guys die or whatever, it's all right. And he would give us gold. And I was like, where are you getting all this gold? I was like, I got it from China.
Right.
okay. Yeah, it was interesting. That's another VR thing, virtual content.
Right.
Selling that content. Right.
Yeah.
What do you think about all the stuff that you guys created at Zovic for all of the games and all the people who are fans and stuff, just selling those assets out for people? That could be something, right?
Yeah, I think technically we don't own that stuff because it's owned by the
Someone could sell it.
Someone could, yeah. Yeah. I think so. I'm sure there's a market there for some of that stuff.
Yeah.
For sure.
So what do you think are some of the biggest challenges, in your life over that period of time when you were sort of going from that transition into visual effects and deciding, to go to full sail all the way till now? What have been some of the biggest challenges for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the decision to actually quit my job and do something else, change careers after I'd spent 7 years establishing myself doing something else. I mean, that was one of the biggest decisions I made because the repercussions of that obviously meant that staying in Florida was not an option.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I had to leave my family, I had to leave my friends, girlfriend.
Was your family always sort of well established in Florida?
No, we had, because I grew up outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
And before Florida, I lived in Arkansas for about 4 years, and I went to high school there. And then after high school, we moved to Florida. I'd been in Florida for about 9 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved there, had a few little minor jobs, and then I got into doing computer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, and then later, after spending a lot of time doing that, really just was not happy and was like, I've got to do something significant. I've got to be happy in what I do.
Right.
And that decision, that's a tough one for a lot of people. If you've been doing something for a long time, I think about that even now.
Also, don't you think it's some of those the right thing to do, right? Because you basically decided to become an artist, right?
Yeah.
And you had a stable job as a computer guy.
Who does that though?
And what we're talking, this is late 90s, right? Something like that,
yeah,
right? So late 90s, you're a computer guy. Everyone thinks you're made. It's all set. You work in computers. You're in the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Late 90s, before the tech crash, 2000.
Yeah.
IT guys, those were That was a place to be.
My wife, not dissimilar from you, she was always very talented as mm-hmm. an artist, and she was also very technical. She was a math major yeah. in college, and she had a job working for a consulting company. You've ever seen Office Space?
Yeah.
That was, I mean, exactly her job.
Yeah.
She was a Y2K consultant dealing with moving bank code. Actually, no, bank code was in Office Space. She was doing an insurance company, so just okay. as bad.
Right.
Moving their old Fortran code to be Y2K compliant.
Nice.
And it was horrible, boring, terrible.
Oh, yeah. Like monotonous.
Yeah. And so I convinced her to quit her job. Or no, she said, I need to quit my job. And it's like, and I supported her in that area. I didn't convince her to do anything.
Sure.
What I did do is I said, maybe you can try being an artist.
Right.
And she's like, because her dad had always been like, an IT guy for a long time.
Sure.
And so he was like, stable job, computers are great.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a hard decision.
It is. It definitely is. And at that time, like, you know, in the mid 90s, I graduated high school in 95. And, mm-hmm. and at that point, you know, that was still early on in the days of visual effects. And so.
Yeah. Jurassic Park was only 2 years before that, right?
Right. And that wasn't really an option. Like that didn't even come to my mind. So it's like, you know, I can't, you know, what am I going to do? I'm just going to see what happens and kind of do what I'm good at. And I'm good at fixing computers and doing computer stuff. And just kind of evolved from there. But, you know, deep down inside, I'd always thought that, you know, I've got to do something that makes me happy. And what makes me happy is, you know, being creative and using my technical skills as well in combination to, you know, create these images and solve problems. And
yeah.
And now it's, you know, for me, the biggest thing is not, doesn't matter really what I'm working on. The big thing for me is who I'm working with and the people.
Do you think that's what's changed in you as a person? Do you think at this point I keep asking you like VR questions or mm-hmm. whatever, like that seems less important to you possibly than just being around a good group of talented artists?
Yeah, whether it would be VR, AR, or visual effects, or anything like that, mm-hmm. like I still want to have that. Still want to do something creative, and in that regard, you know, something in that field, mm-hmm. I'm still very passionate about. But the content of what I'm doing isn't as important,
right?
Like I'm not like, oh, I've got to go work on Avengers 2 or you know whatever. Whatever new Marvel temple, mm-hmm. I've done all that. I've already been through those.
Yeah,
big
you
movies.
Don't care. Anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
I still get amazed. I mean, I still understand. Like every now on Facebook, I'll see someone post a picture of the credits and having their mm-hmm. name on the credits, and I'm happy for them. It's all good.
Sure,
but I feel that people will. The studios will use that for leverage to suck your soul. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all the suffering you did and your name is amongst a sea of names and I don't think it's worth it. I don't know if it's worth it to do that for the credit.
Right. I mean, it all depends on where you're at kind of personally, sure. You know, I think, you know, I went through that period of time in my career where that was important to me, that something like that was.
I know.
You know, I think we all did.
Yeah, absolutely. So did I, for sure.
Yeah. I don't think it was ever, for me, like I never chased that as a thing. Like I was never, like having a credit on a big film wasn't super important. Like, just working on the film, I think, mm-hmm. was more important to me. Like being a part of something that created this massive project and put it all together was interesting to me. But once you did it a few times, it's like, okay, I want to have something where I want to do something to where I can have more of an impact personally you know, on the people around me.
I think the camaraderie that you develop over the course of the show,
yeah,
with your team is huge.
Yeah, it's huge for sure.
You know, because you're sort of in the trenches for a while, and you remember, you know, even me as you know, as a super, you know, you're in the same position, but a much shorter schedule. But I remember, you know, situations like with you where I was like, man, I'm giving Bill a hard time with his stuff, but we worked through it and it looked beautiful and we love it when we see it on the screen. Mm-hmm. But even Art Sion, remember Art?
Yeah.
And you know, there was a moment during Oblivion where Eric Barba was doubting if Art could pull something off. Mm-hmm. And I stood by him. I said, no, Art is going to do this and he's going to be amazing. And I said, in fact, I'm going to give him one of the hardest shots. I'm going to take everything off his plate and give him one of the hardest shots, which was the big shot.
The full CG shot flying through there. Yeah.
And I said, just give him time and small group and I'll get it done. And
that shot was fucking awesome.
The shot was amazing, right?
Exactly.
And he worked his ass off.
Yeah.
And he got it done because he also had a little bit of that generalist thing where it's like, if I can't do it, I'll figure it out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And he did it and it looked amazing. And Eric said, and that's the thing. Like, I felt like, you know, when that shot's done, I want to give him a big hug and like, I'm so proud of you. And he was so happy for it. And we like, you know, and those are rewarding moments, much more than seeing Art's name in the credits, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. When you go down in the trenches with somebody and you come out of it on the other side and you're both alive, you know, they didn't drop a grenade on you.
Yep.
And you know that you pull through it. That's more amazing than having any credit in any movie ever.
I mean,
for me, it's.
And so the support you get from people. It was the last day of Tron, and there was one guy on our team, and I'm not going to necessarily, I don't remember, even remember his name, but it's, but he didn't finish his shot correctly.
Yeah.
And it was seriously messed up. And the compositor was trying to finish, everyone else was partying because I had food trucks and beer and everything else.
Yep.
And the compositor was trying to finish the shot. And it's like, something's seriously wrong with the shot. And I had to fix it. And I already had like five beers. And so I think it was Greg Teagard and Nico sat down and was like, Chris, whatever you need, hot dogs, beer, whatever, we'll give it to you. Just fix the shots.
Right.
And I had to sit there and fix it. And they were like, anything you need, just let us know. We'll get you some music. And they're like, I fixed it. It took me like 3 or 4 hours. But I was like, yeah, that was a crappy experience. But I knew that my team had my back, right?
Sure.
They're like, they're going to like support me on this. I'm going to figure it out. And that's great. You know, you don't feel too left alone. And I think that's a place that, you know, when we look back at our time at DD, there was a lot of that happened. There was a lot of people that were there that were supporting us in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And that was one of the big things about it, was the support and like just being around so many talented people that, you know, it kind of goes back to what I said earlier about having people around you that are better than you. Like, I learned so much and I grew so much as an artist while I was there. And even now, differently, you know, that I'm at Zoic, the time that I've been a supervisor, that's been a huge period of growth. It kind of rejuvenated my passion for this line of work. And, cause you know, I kind of been doing the same thing. I'd been leading and here and there and on projects and been a lighter primarily, but, being a supervisor, I had to dip my toes into everything.
Yeah.
And I had to understand animation, understand effects and all rigging and texturing and all the modeling and all the other aspects that are involved.
Houdini, Fluid Sims.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I had to get my head wrapped around all of that stuff.
Yep.
And so it kind of rejuvenated, it kind of sparked my interest again.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's been really great.
Who's been some of your mentors over the year besides Jeff? Who are those people that have sort of inspired you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Jeff, obviously, he's been a big influence, mm-hmm. kind of just not only as an artist, but, you know, just as a person, just mm-hmm. how to deal with people.
Yeah.
He's great.
Well, that's the thing, right? So you learn when you become a supervisor, you sort of fall into the, you mimic a role of a supervisor that you admired, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
he's very personable. Like I don't have the same kind of personality Jeff does.
Sure.
He's very outgoing, very boisterous.
Right.
I'm exactly the opposite. Right. I'm very laid back and quiet.
Soft-spoken.
Yeah. I was going to say stoic, but you know, soft-spoken.
No, you're not stoic. You're very soft-spoken.
But
you also leave long pauses sometimes to deliver like one of the driest jokes possible at the end of it.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, timing
and delivery. Right. Anticipation.
Yeah. Like artist-wise, John Hewitt probably is one of the greatest like dev guys that I kind of looked up to.
Yeah, I love John.
He was super, super awesome.
I want to have him on the podcast because I want to talk to him about his time as a car designer at Audi.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. He was a car designer.
Yeah. I heard he had a bike accident. He's like, apparently his leg is kind of messed up.
Oh, geez.
I feel bad about John. But he was a brilliant guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
First time I worked with John was on iRobot. He was the main look dev guy on the robots, and I learned so much from that process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome. I think he's over at Disney.
Maybe?
I think so. He was doing like Previs or something.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So John was sort of a really good, I could see that. Absolutely. Yeah,
definitely John from like a lighting look dev mm-hmm. aspect. I've worked with so many great people who've inspired me in different ways, like Hansi Tang. He's been a great friend and mm-hmm. and guy that I learned a lot from.
Yeah.
Darren Hendler, super
yep.
great guy.
He's been on the podcast twice, actually.
Has he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I love Darren. I just did. He's so, what I like about Darren, again, he's soft spoken, but he's very excitable too.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's awesome.
And Hansi, I've known, speak about one of the driest, most sarcastic people in the world. Yeah. I've known him for a while.
He's talking about more sarcastic and dry than me.
Yeah, no, he is. He's very, very funny. And I want to have him on the podcast because he deserves some congratulations and praise for joining the Academy this year. So,
yeah, that's right.
He's a really cool guy. But what about supervisor? You mentioned Jeff as a supervisor. What were some of the guys that inspired you?
Darren Hendler was my supervisor for a bit on a few shows at DD. Mm. He was always really great. I worked with Nikos.
Nikos.
He's awesome.
Nikos was always like he was like the drill sergeant though.
Yeah. Yeah, he kept everybody kind of.
Yeah, he was like, I don't care how it's done. Here it is on the schedule. You figure it out.
Right.
Go, go, go. What do you need to get it done? Then let's get that done.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was very much that way.
You need that sometimes. You know?
Yeah, you do. You do. It's interesting. I've had, you know, different ways of, there's been certain people, and they're so different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
The three that I can think of, they're the most different, but the most interesting one was, Kevin Mack.
Okay.
I work with him at Sony. Now, he is the trippiest of all of them.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of hallucinogenics in his time, and I think he'll be nice. Okay if I said that. But he had a really interesting way, because every time he delivered things, he was like very funny and dreamy and had mm-hmm. all these weird, funny things. But then when he actually said what he wanted, it was extraordinarily clear.
Yeah, that's pretty pretty rare that you find that, because usually you've got people who are very in that kind of floaty, dreamy, like very. Right.
I want something that looks like this and that, but then he would tell you exactly, and it's like, that's actually very clear what you want.
Right.
The other thing he always did that I noticed is at the end of him explaining things or tearing your shot apart if it was completely the wrong thing, he'd always say, "Thank you so much. I can't wait to see that tomorrow." And he would say that, and it was like, it's very nice. And it was sincere and it felt good. So that was one thing that I learned. Like, that was really nice. The second supervisor that I think is very interesting is Eric Nash.
Yep.
Eric Nash comes from the practical world, et cetera. He was the ultimate important sampling guy, right? That's important. We need to fix that. I don't worry about that one. That's fine. Well, that's going to work. And he was really good at that. Then the third one is Eric Barba, who was the most, you know, unbiased. Like, everything had to be perfect.
Right.
Things that were off the screen had to be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I had only worked with Barba on Oblivion, and you know, I had a great experience on that show overall.
But the results on the screen are speak to themselves, right? But it's hard.
Yeah, getting there, it's gonna be a tough road.
Yeah,
but in the end, it's gonna be worth it.
And what from the personality level, what was interesting about Eric is that he would make you work hard to earn his trust, to earn his level. And I was like, and I liked all three of those. I think were unique people. But I was always the guy in school that liked the asshole teacher, the teacher that would be the toughest.
Right.
Because somehow that made me want to do something better about it. Like it actually encouraged me to do something.
Yeah. I mean, people take that either one of two ways. They either get encouraged and want to challenge themselves.
Yeah.
Or they're like, you know, F that guy or F that person.
I did have a Latin teacher that, this is back when I was in a French school a long time ago. She just hated me and she would make fun of me. Mm. And that was not a good relationship with a teacher for sure.
Right.
But some teachers that are really tough and like, nah, you can do better. Blah, blah, and I was like, oh, you know,
yeah.
Sometimes that's good.
Yeah. I think it's definitely good where people don't feel like, I feel like there's not enough, I guess, struggle and challenge in people's lives these days. I think we look at today, this is the easiest time to be a human being, you know?
Yeah, it is pretty easy.
We live very, you know, here in...
Depending on where you live.
Depending on where you are, for sure.
Sure.
Generally speaking, it's definitely the easiest time. You go back even 500 years ago, and it's a totally different ballgame. I mean, 80% of us would probably be dead.
You know, I know I'd be dead.
Right, I would be too, man.
There's no visual effects 500 years ago. No. What kind of crazy, I'll have to be a troubadour or something silly like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. We do have the fact that jobs like our jobs exist is...
Yeah, it's evidence of that.
It's evidence of that.
For sure.
Yeah.
What does that mean for us, though? Like, where does that take us?
I don't know. You know, I don't feel that everyone has the responsibility to cure cancer.
Yeah, I don't either.
I think, you know, there are certain jobs out there that, you know, a lot of people look at our content, right? A lot of people look at the stuff that you create on TV and they're inspired by it, you know? They can't wait to go home and watch, you know, the next episode of, you know, High Man in the Castle. Then that's one of the shows you guys do, right?
Man in the High Castle.
Man in the High Castle, yeah.
We did the pilot. We don't work on the series anymore.
Okay, well, whatever. Something like that. You know, they can't wait to see the next Arrow. It's like, oh, Arrow's coming out tonight. I can't wait to see what happens with him, you know? So that, you know, you're not necessarily providing, curing that person's cancer, but you're providing that person an escape, right?
Yeah.
You're providing that person something that inspires them and makes them feel good and relaxes them. And and that's not a bad thing, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point to understand is that, yeah, our jobs can be stressful and the things that we do, you know, we've got really tight deadlines and we're trying to get stuff out at a really high quality. But at the end of the day, we're not curing cancer. Mm-hmm. We're not saving babies' lives.
Yep.
So let's all be kind to each other and just get through this together.
I have a great story for you. It's from a friend of mine who was a dolly grip. Mm-hmm. And he's been a dolly grip for like the big movies, like Spider-Man and stuff like that, right? I think it was on Spider-Man. What was the one with Doc Ock? Two?
Yeah, two. Amazing Spider-Man.
Yes. And he was apparently, you know, that they put a huge budget into that movie, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And he was working with very, very well, because he was a dolly grip. He was working with a very well-known DP on that film or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And they had to get move the dolly through the set. So I had to shut up the dolly for the shot. And then this part of the set was there. And they said, we got to move that part of the set out of the way so the dolly can go there. Well, as you may know, on set, they don't build things out of real materials because they need to move shit around, right? So he assumed it was like a big statue of a lion or whatever, that it was built out of foam, but it wasn't. It was built out of stone. And I was like, God damn it. I was like, how are we going to move this thing? I got to get the dolly here. We're not going to make the shot. We got to da, 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 da. And he was stressing out about it, understandably. I was like, why would they build that out of stone? And apparently the DP looked at him and goes, hey, Greg, chill out. Chill out. Don't worry about it. It's like, you know what people are going to say after they see this movie? He says, what? What do you want to do for dinner?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's it.
Yeah.
I know that's what I do. It's like, hey, that was a fun movie. Should we go over to Yard House and get a beer and have something to eat?
Let's go get some food.
Yeah. And that's what it comes down to.
Yep.
So we're not curing cancer. We're not doing stuff. But I mean, yeah, sometimes the stress is there because we want to meet a deadline or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you're working on a big project. It means, you know, a lot to the company that you're working with to do a good job. That's going to bring more business back for you in the future.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's definitely, there can be a lot of stress, especially the higher you go up, you know, as you become, you have more responsibilities, you know, as a supervisor, VFX supervisors.
Right.
Got a lot of weight on their shoulders.
Yeah.
So.
But don't take it too seriously. Have fun. Remember to have fun.
Yeah. It's all about perspective.
Cool. All right. Well, Bill, this has been amazing.
Yeah, man.
We're wrapping up the end. Sorry we had to false start at the beginning, but I think we recovered pretty well from that one.
Yeah, definitely, man. Should have done this way sooner.
And we can still do lunch more often. So anytime you're like, hey, I'm not doing anything, I'll call Chris. Just seriously, just call me up.
Yeah, for sure, man.
All right.
Cool.
Thanks.